This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. The transfer of presidential power from Trump to Biden and the confirmation of Kamala Harris as vice president has caused political ripple effects stretching to California and the San Joaquin Valley. To discuss what has changed in our political landscape, I spoke to Desi Woods Jones, California State President of Black Women Organized for Political Action and former vice mayor of Oakland, Ben Christopher, political reporter for CalMatters, and Lisa Bryant, associate professor of political science at Fresno State. I want to start this conversation with California State Senator Shannon Grove of Bakersfield. On Wednesday, she lost her role as leader of the California Senate Republican Caucus as a result of a tweet that she posted briefly and then removed. But this tweet was on January 6th, and it claimed that the insurrectionists at the U.S. Capitol were members of Antifa as opposed to being supporters of President Trump. Now, she herself has been a vocal supporter of President Trump, but that support backfired this week. So, Lisa, I would love to get your thoughts on what the implications of this could or could not be. I mean, do you think that the loss of that leadership position was truly just in response to that one tweet, or could it signal perhaps a fracturing within California Republicans?
I think it's more than just the one tweet. I think, you know, California Republicans lost two more seats in the Senate, so I believe that they have only 9 Senate seats now. And so I think that replacing somebody who has been very Trump loyal and represents a more conservative side of the Republican Party in California is really a sign that the California Republicans for, you know, a couple of years now have been trying to, let's say, put up a bigger tent, right, and draw more people in. And so when we saw, you know, the selection of Jessica Milan Patterson, a Latina, as the chair of the GOP, and now we see sort of replacing Shannon Groves with a more moderate Republican, I think that what they're trying to do is they realize that, you know, being hyper-conservative is not a great way to attract a lot of people into the party, maybe, in California. The Central Valley is certainly a little bit different than other parts of the state. And so I think that they're really trying to play a sort of navigate more moderate space and attract more people into the party. So I don't think it was just the one tweet. I think that the party has been shifting away from sort of the more conservative stances overall.
Ben Christopher, based on your reporting, I mean, does this all track with what you're hearing from California Republicans?
No, yeah, I think what Lisa said is absolutely right. It's not just the tweet. There has been momentum in this direction to get Grove replaced for some time. As Lisa mentioned, the caucus lost two incumbents in November, and obviously the job of, or one of the main jobs of a leader in a chamber is to protect their members, and so when two incumbents don't win, that's not really consistent with that job description, and particularly at a time when, actually, if you look at the Republicans in the Assembly or in Congress in California, they actually had a fairly decent year. They picked up some seats, and so I think that was part of the problem. I think it's fair to say the tweet probably didn't help. I heard some folks plugged into the process who said that it hurried the process along, and I think it is no coincidence that the replacement for Senator Grove as the leader is Senator Scott Wilk, who really ideologically is sort of sits at the opposite end of the political spectrum from Senator Grove. He's one of the most moderate, if not the most moderate, members in the caucus. He represents a swing district in Santa Clarita. And so I think to the extent that this should be taken as a sort of a shift in a different direction, a post-Trump kind of shift for the caucus, I think the fact that they've picked Wilk sort of represents that, I think.
Lisa Bryant, I'd like to come back to you. I'm just wondering what your feelings are or thoughts are about how officials like, let's say, a Devin Nunes is feeling about this moment and what concerns he may have about how his past positions may come into play when he comes before voters again.
I think, you know, it's actually really interesting if you look at sort of 3 of our big name Democrats in the Valley. You've got Nunes and McCarthy and David Valadao, and Valadao is the only one who, you know, vote to impeach. And he is in a district that is highly competitive. You know, he lost his seat and he just gained it back. And so he sort of has to walk that. It's very similar to the state party, right? He has to sort of navigate that middle sort of moderate terrain so that he can appeal to no party preference voters or maybe just right-leaning voters as opposed to strong Republicans, as opposed to somebody like Nunes, who's in a pretty secure, or at least historically has been in a pretty secure district. And I think here in Fresno, I haven't heard, you know, there's been a fair amount of discussion about how loyal he's been to Trump and Trump policies. And of course, he got the medal from Trump just before Trump left office. But I haven't heard a lot of discussion about how that might hurt him down the road. You know, this last election, Arbaio did come closer than other candidates have come in the past to unseating Nunes, but I think that he's probably pretty secure. McCarthy, on the other hand, you know, McCarthy's been sort of navigating interesting space as well, because he had calls for help. He was inside the Capitol, you know, when it was stormed, obviously. He had calls for help, which he felt went ignored, and sort of came out speaking out against that. But then, of course, he didn't vote to impeach, and he did cast votes that the election might not be, you know, accurate. And so I think that that opens him up probably to some valid attack from a challenge. Yes, to some valid attack from a challenger. And I think that we'll see that play out in 2 years.
Well, before we jump too far in the future, I want to look back on this week and talk a bit about the inauguration, which was, of course, the big news. Desi, I have to ask you, as the California state president of Black Women Organized for Political Action, I have to get your reaction to the swearing-in of Kamala Harris as the first Black woman to serve as the vice president of the United States.
Well, my goodness, what can I tell you other than I'm ecstatic? As the old folks used to say in my time, I am happy, glad. It was an exciting time to know that we finally have arrived at a place as African-American women where we can look and see that the second highest office in the land is filled by African-American and South Asian-American woman. We're happy about that. We're excited about that. We're excited about Joe Biden. We're excited about the new team, because we know now that we can begin to hopefully see movement from 4 years of just hatred and division and divisiveness. So we're excited about that. But I have to quickly follow that by saying, as happy as we are to see our sister Kamala move in that position, and I have to let you know that she is a lifetime member of our organization, BWAPA, which makes it even more special. I've had the opportunity of hosting her throughout the state of California and right here in the Valley in Fresno and Madera, at my home and at other places when she's running for either Senate or the presidency. And so we have a very, very close relationship. So if I could have, and if it had not been for COVID, I'd have been right there and all of the stuff to witness that. But again, having said that, we are likewise concerned about the work that is still yet to be done for African-American women. It's interesting to me now that we hear all the time, and even from our president, who has said it several times, Black women has been, over the years, the backbone of the Democratic Party, the backbone of our many times in our governance. And yet, this is something we have been saying all the time. This is not new to us. We know that African-American women have been the largest percentage of voters in this nation, barring none, for many, many years, and have made a significant difference. But yet, we are the least represented. And so for us, as much as we support and we respect and we're grateful to see Alex Padilla, who was appointed to fill Kamala's seat, as you all know, by our Governor Gavin, and he is now the first Latina serving in the United States Senate. We're not angry with Alex, because he's done great work here in California. I know him. We respect him. But we are disappointed because that left a void in the United States Senate. We have not one African-American woman elected to the United States Senate. With Kamala's election when she came in 2016, it was only two. She was only the second one in the history of our nation to have served there. That for us is appalling and not acceptable. So to pat us on the back on one hand and say great African-American women are the backbone of our nation and our politics, but yet it is not represented, is unacceptable for black women throughout the state in this nation. So our work is still very much on the forefront. And as an organization, and we network with organizations all over this nation, we're going to continue to make sure that African-American women are sitting at the tables of decision-making. So it's great that Kamala's there. We love it. We know that's going to be a different access. But we clearly need to make sure that at every level of this nation, locally, statewide, and nationally, that African-American women have a voice in the leadership and the policy-making issues of this country. So, again, yes, I'm ecstatic. Yes, I am happy. Yes, she has broken barriers. Yes, she is an inspiration to many, some of us old who have been out here in the movement for 60 years, and certainly the young people who are aspiring to be the next Kamalas of the world. We are excited about that. But we recognize we have work to be to do, and so we're not sitting back on our laurels thinking that all of this is now put to bed and put to rest.
Well, of course, as Desi mentioned, Kamala Harris was replaced in the Senate by Alex Padilla. Lisa, I would love for you to jump in and weigh in on this. Now that Alex Padilla is in the Senate, what is he going to have to do from a policy perspective to resonate with voters once it comes time to go up for re-election?
I think Alex Padilla, he was born out of, when he was, you know, elected down in Los Angeles, off of his immigration policy positions. And I think immigration policy is always on the minds of Californians. And I think he should really use his strengths and what he knows to try and advocate for immigration reform in D.C. And I think that for most of his voters, that would be a policy area that they would be happy to see some progress on. I mean, certainly there's been a lot of questions about our immigration policy and where reform is needed over the last couple of years. I think the other really big strength he has that he's taking with him to D.C. is his role as an election official and an election administrator. You know, I mean, in this last election cycle, and certainly even in 2016, there were lots of questions about election integrity and election security and election fraud. And while we do have an FEC, a Federal Elections Commission, they're primarily an advisory agency at this point. And I think there's going to be some calls for better election securities and how we combat claims of fraud. How do we make the processes more transparent? And Padilla has a good history of that and good experience doing that. And so I think that if he became a leader in that front as well, you know, the Californians would probably be quite happy to see that. And so I think those are a couple of his areas of expertise that he can really use and keep voters in the state happy. I mean, certainly there's more to be done than that. Infrastructure is a huge thing, water. But I do think that those are areas of strength that he's taking with him.
If I can jump in real quick, Kathleen, on that. Lisa, I certainly could agree with you with regard to immigration reform. I think that's critical and always has been in, for us in California. But I think one of the other areas, of course, is health care and certainly economic security. For, again, minorities across the board, whether they're African-American, Latino, Asian, we struggle with a lot of the health care. So one of the good things now is that we, since, again, the Democratic Party, as you will, who has, of course, been strongly supportive of making sure that we have health care available to our citizens, now have the majority of the Senate. We hope to see the movement, but I think that's going to be critical for, again, Alex to continue to push in that direction, as well as, again, economic security. I mean, a lot of people, as we all know, partly as it relates to COVID and this pandemic, have really lost their footing. But again, because I represent African-American women, I have to let you know that, again, we have lost much more than anyone else in terms of positions and jobs and small businesses. Our businesses are closed and may not have the possibility of reopening. So we're reaching out, trying to do a lot of, again, support in that area. So I think it's critical as well for him to certainly pay attention to some of those areas as well.
So Alex Padilla replaced Kamala Harris. The next question is then, who's going to replace Alex Padilla? We have an answer now. It is Shirley Weber. Ben Christopher, you have talked to Weber and reported on her. What can you tell us about Shirley Weber?
Well, historically, it's quite significant. She would be and likely will be the first Black Californian to serve as Secretary of State. And if you look at her life story, the fact that she comes from a family from Arkansas that was deprived of the right to vote, was literally chased from the state by a lynch mob, that she is now going to be in a position to serve as the state's top election regulator. I think there's definitely a symbolism to that. Certainly, I don't think that symbolism was lost on Governor Newsom when he decided to appoint her. Her background in the legislature and prior to that is really in education policy. And she talked, when I was speaking to her, she talked a lot about using the Secretary of State role as really a platform to talk about and educate the public about civics and civic responsibility and the relationship between voting and governance. And, you know, to be honest, when we were talking, it was around New Year's Day, and a part of me thought, well, you know, this is just something that you say, and, you know, how really relevant is that? But then, of course, I think that message really resonates a little differently after the events of January 6th with the storming of the Capitol, and really just, I think, a reminder to all of us of how fragile American democracy is. And so I think the message that she has been making, that she wants to be sort of a civic educator, it rings a little differently, I think.
So, Ben, I'd like to stick with you. If you could just quickly explain for me what's going on with California's proposed budget. You know, Newsom has proposed a just record-breakingly large budget. Where is this money coming from, and what is he planning to do with it?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I mean, I thought the economy was doing quite poorly, and then all of a sudden we have this giant budget. And it's a good question. Where is that money coming from? We're actually looking at about a $16 billion windfall or a surplus, a sort of a one-time pot of money that the state is going to have to spend. And a lot of this actually comes down to expectations. So if we go back to last June when the budget was put together, there was such a sense of pessimism about where the economy was going. There were lots of cuts made, some fees were increased based on the assumption that tax revenue was really going to fall off a cliff. And it didn't, which obviously is good. Income tax, particularly, and capital gains revenue has come in quite a bit higher than expected. And unfortunately, the sad side of that, the downside of that, is that that's a reflection of the fact that the economic pain of this recession has really disproportionately hit poor and working class Californians, whereas rich Californians, many can work from home. They're generally doing fine. The stock market is doing quite well for reasons that don't quite make sense to me. And so because the state gets most of it, or the lion's share of its tax revenue from the wealthiest, the highest income earners, the state is actually sitting now on a surprise almost $16 billion. And so now there's a lot of tussling in Sacramento over what to do with that pot of cash. Earlier this month, the governor introduced his budget proposal, which is just a proposal. So we're going to see months of sort of tussling over this. But he's talking about sending another little stimulus check, so a $600 check to low-income Californians. That would be on top of the checks that are going out from the federal government, tax credits and grants to small businesses. A lot of money for schools to try and incentivize school districts to reopen in the coming months. A lot of pushback from both unions and districts on that, so we'll see how that goes. And then a little over $3 billion going to pay down debt, prepaying pension liabilities, and putting more money back into the state's rainy day fund.
Lisa Bryant, I'm going to have to give you the last word. I wish we had more time, but when you look at Newsom's ability now to maybe recenter his original priorities, now that the budget is what it is, do you think that's going to help him politically, particularly as it pertains to these, you know, growing calls for a recall?
I mean, when the economy is doing well, people usually keep their positions. And so it's kind of like both Ben and Desi alluded to, that this she session, as they're calling it, has been unequal in nature, right? So it's hitting women harder, it's hitting poorer communities harder. However, I think Newsom tends to have a stronghold in those communities. And so if people turn out, then, you know, if the recall actually does happen, which they still have a fair number of signatures to collect by March for that to even happen. But if so, I think that he's probably fairly safe in that. It's really unusual and interesting to see. And I think economically things are going to be okay. And, you know, it's like Ben said, you get this idea that the economy's been bad. But I've been saying all along, man, it's really hard to see if you go to Target or you go to the grocery store or you go to get, you know, takeout food. It's like people are everywhere all the time and they're spending money, and online sales have increased by 8% or whatever. And the state's you know, getting some sales tax out of that and stuff too. And so it's like spending is happening. It's just happening. It's very sort of disproportional and where it's been cut back, right? It's been cut back in the service sector, and that's hurting those poor communities. And so it'll be interesting to see how all of that plays out for Newsom. I think he's probably okay, but, you know, it remains to be seen.
Yeah, time will tell. Well, I've been talking with Lisa Bryant, Associate Professor of Political Science at Fresno State, Ben Christopher, Political Reporter for CalMatters, and Desi Woods Jones, State President for Black Women Organized for Political Action. Thank you all for a fantastic conversation.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.